name is Ryan Smart. I'm a fourth year education student and am the president of the Sydney University Evangelical Union, the group which is hosting this great debate today. And it's my pleasure to welcome you into this grand building, and I'm really glad that you have come along. And it's an appropriate time now. If you do have a mobile phone, you might like to turn it off. For the next 2 weeks, the EU is asking you, as well as our university, to investigate what I think is a very important and intelligent question. Has God failed us? We are starting our investigation today with a debate on the existence and the relevance of God. We're going to hear, it's going to be a moderated debate. So let me introduce you to our moderator, Andrew Cadet. Andrew has had a long association with the University of Sydney and also the EU, and he's currently the senior minister at St. John's Ashfield Anglican Church. Andrew will just introduce the topic to us briefly, explain the format of the debate, as well as introduce you to our speakers. Thank you, Andrew.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've picked an interesting and provocative topic for our debate this afternoon, one that allows us to get beyond peripheral issues and really to the heart of the matter, that God has failed us, a debate on the existence and relevance of God. The format for this afternoon will be as follows. We'll begin with two opening speeches by our speakers of 15 minutes each. At the end of that 15 minutes, if the speaker's still speaking, there'll be a bell. They know that, and I'm just telling you that also, so you don't get surprised if that happens. After those initial 15-minute speeches, I will moderate a discussion for 20 minutes. The goal of that is to ensure that our speakers engage thoroughly with each other. And at the end of that 20 minutes, I'm hoping that'll be 1:56, and so you'll be able to head off to a 2 o'clock lecture if necessary. However, we have the room booked till 3 o'clock. And so whether you're here in the Great Hall or over in McLaurin Hall on the video link-up and would like to participate in that question time, from 2 till 3, we'll have a 5-minute break, pause in proceedings for those that need to leave, we'll reform, and then host a question time to further explore the issues. Inelis Jones is a senior lecturer in law at the University of Technology, Sydney, and formerly president of the Humanist Society. Please welcome him for his opening speech.
Good afternoon, and thanks for being here. The Bishop and I have agreed, for the purposes of this debate, that the word God should be used in its traditional sense to refer to a supernatural, personal, or superpersonal being who is all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving, and everywhere present, and who, according to the Christian scriptures, took human form uniquely in the person of Jesus Christ, who was both fully human as well as being fully divine. Now, how can the atheist, in good conscience, argue that someone whose existence he denies has failed us? To argue in the affirmative is to concede the a priori existence of God, something the atheist in good conscience can't do. And of course, God, by definition, can't fail, being perfect, omnipotent, infallible. For God to fail, God would have to contradict himself. Impossible. Now, the real issue is whether the God hypothesis of Christianity has failed. It is my submission that that hypothesis has indeed failed us and cannot succeed in any event. Firstly, I will show that there are no good reasons for believing that the Christian God, the God of the Bible, exists. Secondly, I will show that there are more than good reasons for believing that that God does not exist. And thirdly, even if the God hypothesis were empirically valid and God was real, I attempt to show that the hypothesis is otherwise unacceptable on other grounds. Firstly, no good reasons for believing that the God of the Bible exists. One, the supposed existence of a supernatural being presupposes the existence of some order or level of reality exempt from, or not otherwise bound by, natural law. However, the existence of more than one order or level of reality is contrary to the very nature and possibility of meaningful discourse. It's unspeakable, incomprehensible, and ontologically self-contradictory. Now, this is not some naturalistic presupposition on my part. We simply can have no conception of any order or level of existence other than natural existence. Supernaturalism can't be validated either empirically or philosophically. It has no special empirical traits that distinguish it from naturalistic alternatives, and any of its supposed attributes can be seen to be either attributes of the natural world itself or simply unnecessary in any event. Calling something supernatural says nothing. It's stating what the supposed entity is not. It says nothing about what it supposedly is. Two, it's impossible to establish God's existence by logical reasoning, because that starts from some basic given. In this case, God's the basic given. If God's at the end of a sound syllogism instead of at its start, then it's not God we're talking about, but some corollary to some more basic reality or truth. Thirdly, God's existence can't be established scientifically. The necessary elements of a good scientific test, randomness, control conditions, double-blind, prospective repeatability, are inapplicable to the God hypothesis. The God hypothesis fails once again. Four, all the traditional philosophical arguments or so-called proofs for God's existence are fundamentally flawed and must be rejected. I haven't got time to go through them all, but let's take a couple of the more prominent ones. The cosmological argument, the world must have had a cause. Now, even if that be true, the argument fails to support the thesis that the Christian God exists, or is the cause of the universe's beginning to exist. Even if the universe had a cause, and the current scientific evidence is very much to the contrary, we've no reason to believe that the supposed cause has any of the properties that the Christian God supposedly has. All we have reason to believe is that the supposed cause is slightly more powerful than its effects, which is all that's required. We've no reason to believe that it's all-powerful. Further, if it's possible to think of God as uncaused or self-caused, then it's possible and much more sensible to think the same of the universe itself, as Charles Darwin pointed out. Also, all of our observations of causation relate to pre-existing things changing from one state to another. Here we're talking about things coming into existence for the first time. And quantum mechanics has shown that not all things are uncaused. Sorry, that some things are uncaused. Then there's the teleological argument. The world shows evidence of intelligent design. This argument assumes what it tries to prove. Although there may be design in the universe, but any universe would look designed, no matter how it came into existence, to speak of design of the universe is theistic semantics. And if intelligence means that the universe has some previously intended purpose, what right do we have to assume that there must be a purpose behind everything? The universe isn't planned, in my submission. It's simply there, behaving in the way it does as the result of the wholly non-purposive workings of natural selection. As regards the notion of intelligent design, even if the universe operates in a way that our mind can interpret as rational, that in itself doesn't support the existence of some intelligent being behind it all. It's not an explanation of its own existence. If the universe is wonderfully designed, then God must have had an even more wonderful designer. Silly? Well, if God didn't require a designer, there's no reason to believe why a relatively less wonderful thing as the universe needed one. The teleological argument, in all its various forms, is based on analogies with machines and other human-made things like watches and motor vehicles, which of course have been designed and made by someone. And even if the analogy worked cosmically, which it doesn't, it would at the most show the existence of some sort of cosmic architect responsible for the design and construction of things as opposed to their actual existence. Once again, the argument for God's existence, this one, doesn't prove that the Christian God exists. Then there's the argument based on the immediate experience of God in the form of Jesus Christ, that we can know God or Jesus exists by simply experiencing him. In other words, God or Jesus exists because we can know that they exist. The fallacy of this argument should be obvious to all. Nothing is constituted by being known. Even Dr. William Lane Craig, who still drags out this old warhorse regularly, admits it isn't really an argument for God's existence at all. Now, these and all other arguments for God's existence are more appropriately arguments for God's non-existence. Secondly, there are more than good reasons for believing that God doesn't exist. Firstly, there is credible scientific theory and evidence that the universe began without having been caused and without a beginning in time. The claim that the beginning of our universe had a cause conflicts with the findings of people like Stephen Hawking, Andre Vilenkin, Alex Lind, and many others. Quantum mechanics, the wave function of the universe, its ever-accelerating space expansion rate, the theory of relativity presuppose the existence of a universe that is spatially infinite in both directions, totally self-contained, no boundaries, making it highly probable, indeed almost 100% we're told, that a universe with our universe's characteristics will come into existence uncaused. The universe exists. Why? Because it has an unconditional, predominant probability of existing based on a functional law of nature. Now, our spatially infinite, self-contained universe doesn't have a cause because it doesn't need one. Everything in the universe, every part of the universe, has a cause, having been caused by some other part of the universe. There's nothing lacking a cause, so there's nothing that needs God for a cause. Everything that does exist has a cause. So the universe, the sum of all parts, has been self-caused. If you add God to it, what did God do? If God exists, God was already caused to exist by some other part of the universe. In short, God is empirically and epistemically unnecessary, that is, not required to explain anything. Secondly, the Bible asserts not only the existence of God, but also God's pre-existence, and that notion is contrary to science and reason. God's supposed pre-existence requires a context of time. Before is a time concept, but under the laws of physics, especially relativity theory, time can't precede space. There can be no time before there was a universe. Even St. Augustine recognized that. Time and space must always go together. Indeed, they're now recognized as being one, space-time. If a supposedly supernatural God had an existence or presence before reality, before the supposed creation of all that is, then God must be unreal, and therefore not God, for it's impossible to postulate a reality before it was present. Thirdly, the idea of God is inherently and irredeemably contradictory. And under the philosophical law of contradiction, anything that involves a contradiction can't exist. God supposedly exists outside of time, but God is supposed to think and create. They're both time-related activities. In other words, God's supposedly timeless, but also causally efficacious. In other words, can affect material objects. But the only timeless things around are abstract objects like numbers and sets, and they have no causal properties. But we're told that God is both abstract and has causal properties. That's a contradiction. And nothing with a contradictory nature exists or can exist. The God hypothesis fails again. Now, according to William Lane Craig in his book Time and Eternity, he says, outside of time, God is eternal. With creation, God has entered time. But God's supposedly immutable, and yet we're told God has changed. If God's not subject to time, having entered the natural world from outside, whatever that means, because there's nothing outside the universe, God can no longer be supernatural or infinite. It's impossible to speak meaningfully of the infinite acting in the finite, the non-temporal acting in time or entering into time. Here's another contradiction. Why would a supposedly supernatural God bother to create a natural universe, assuming it was created? Did God feel a lack of something, needed companionship? Then God was not perfect in himself, because creationism and perfectionism are mutually exclusive. Further, the existence in the world of gratuitous evil and suffering. Evil or suffering is gratuitous if, in the view of reasonable people, the world would be improved by its absence. The existence of such evil and suffering is, in my view, incompatible with the notion of an all-powerful, all-loving God. I'm well aware of the arguments that the bishop will probably raise in relation to that. My submission is that an all-powerful God would be perfectly able to create human beings who were genuinely free, but who only use their free will to do good. Further, if an all-knowing God foresaw the fall, as we're told that he did, then he's responsible for all that's ensued. And if such a God does exist, then in my opinion, he's unworthy of worship. Another contradiction. Has God a body? If so, where is it? For if God doesn't have a body, the various properties attributed to God, like powerful, loving, good, just, are misleading, because all such predicates apply to bodies whose behaviours are physically observable and not to disembodied minds. Lastly, the concept of God as an infinite personality is inconceivable in my submission and ontologically self-contradictory. Thirdly and finally, the otherwise unacceptability of the God hypothesis. Woody Allen once quipped, "If it turns out that there is a God, I don't think that he's evil, but the worst that you can say about him is that he's basically an underachiever." But the God of the Bible is the most unattractive overachiever, a failure by human standards of decency. According to the Bible, God deliberately killed every living thing on earth, murdered innocent children as well as the unborn, commanded the murder of homosexuals, murdered over 50,000 people because they looked into the ark. And contrary to his own teaching, Jesus, the so-called Son of God, often called down curses upon his opponents, was unnecessarily cruel to animals, the Gadarene swine, caused wanton destruction to vegetation, the fig tree incident, and will supposedly return to torture and kill billions. Revelation 19, 13 to 18. And insofar as Jesus is concerned, in my submission, there's insufficient evidence to conclude that he was a real historical person. The New Testament accounts, the faith of the believing church, are internally contradictory, and historically unreliable. What few references there are to Jesus outside the Christian scriptures in the writings of people like Josephus, Pliny the Younger, and Tacitus don't establish his historicity. There's not so much as one single piece of demonstrably authentic evidence, whether documentary, archaeological, or forensic, that Jesus was ever alive. There's some dubious material attesting to certain people believing that there was once a person named Jesus who was killed and who was worshipped by some as some sort of a god, but none actually attesting to the fact that he was alive. Finally, in conclusion, the anthropomorphic Christian God, in my submission, is nothing more than an imaginative or psychological projection of the human mentality. In Freudian terms, a superego, superconsciousness. The God hypothesis has failed miserably and can't possibly succeed in any event.
Thank you, Ian. Dr. Glenn Davies is the Anglican Bishop of North Sydney. Please welcome him for his opening address.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm sure Ian and I are both happy that there's a debate at the university where both debaters actually turn up.
It's very encouraging.
For both our sake, and that actually people turn up to hear us. So thank you very much indeed. I want to speak to this topic, has God failed us, at three levels. The first, that God is real. The second, that God has not failed. And the third, that God has succeeded. You'll notice that Ian indicated that we'd agreed on the nature of the God of whom we speak. I propose to you not some kind of made-up sense of God, not the God of our imagination in the final remarks of my opponent, but rather the God of the Bible, the God who's revealed himself, the God of which I believe and the God of which I speak, and the God who has not failed this world, is a God who's revealed himself to us in space and time. It's all very well to think in terms of a God who can't exist because if he's not in space and time, but that's merely a category error. You can't answer the question, how big is red? It's a category error to ask the size of redness. In the same way, it's a category error to use indicators like space and time to speak of the Creator. God is not created. God is outside our sense and understanding at that level. God supersedes our wildest dreams and imaginations. God is the all-powerful creator of everyone in this room, everyone in this planet, this whole world and cosmos as we know it. The universe may be infinite. We don't really know. We've never got to the end of it to find out. But God is infinite. And how do I know that? On what basis do I assert that? Have I calculated some kind of ground level assumptions whereby I might work out what God is like? No, it comes from the fact that God has revealed himself to us. God has not left us alone. God has not left us in a vacuum. God has entered our world and he's spoken to our world and he's spoken with clarity. And that's why the basis is the Bible. It's that God I'm speaking of. I wouldn't seek to use the theological arguments in terms of trying to work out the design matter, the very point that Ian indicated, that might get you to some kind of designer, but does it get you to the Christian God? No, it doesn't, I don't think. In actual fact, what we have to do is, in any argumentation, work on the basis of our presuppositions. What are our building blocks for knowledge? How do we have this debate in the first place? In many ways, it would be a curious debate, would it not, to be sitting here having a debate as to, are there foundations to the Great Hall? We could have a great conversation with regard to that, going backwards and forwards, thinking through, looking at the walls, thinking maybe there's something there, but we can't see it. But our very debate is predicated upon the existence of a foundation. We couldn't be sitting in the Great Hall if there was no foundation. Human speech, human reasoning, is predicated upon God. God is the God who brings meaning into the world. Without God, there would be no meaning. We've all seen the awful situation with the Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and we've been aghast with regard to the terrible fury of that hurricane. But what's brought us even more horror has been the way in which humans have turned upon humans in that great city. We're horrified because we have a sense of value with regard to human life. We think it's wrong for people to prey upon others. We think it's wrong for greed to take over with regard to our world. We think it's wrong to actually to rape people, to murder people, to abuse people, to steal from people. Where do those values come from? Are those values some kind of social construct? Is it just a matter in which way it helps society move along? There's something innate about our understanding of values that, yes, values actually have a core element for us. And those values come from the living God. If you think back in terms of the way in which you argue, we all have our values. You have values with regard to the way in which you live your life. You have a hierarchy of values even. There are certain values which you think are greater. The enjoyment of life might be greater than going to lectures, for example. You might have a value in terms of truth or probity. If you're a parent, you might have a value with regard to bringing no harm to your children. And yet in that hierarchy of values, you'll actually bring pain to your children. You'll actually take them to the dentist and pay for it. You'll take them to the doctor and get inoculation and allow pain to take place for your child whom you love because you've got a hierarchy of values. Where do those values come from? Are they merely arbitrary? Jean-Paul Sartre said, look, everyone just can lead an authentic life. This is, we live in a subjective world. We don't need the objectivity of values. But we all live in a world in which there are oughts and musts. And indeed, Jean-Paul Sartre said, you must allow me to lead an authentic life. Upon what grounds must I allow him to do that? It becomes self-defeating. God is the one who brings meaning into our world. God is the one who reveals himself to us. The way in which he was described by Ian, and we agreed, the word God is used in the traditional sense, the supernatural, personal, or the superpersonal being who is all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving, everywhere present, and who, according to the Christian scriptures, that's the God that I believe in. That's the God who has not failed us. Just because we can't see him doesn't mean he doesn't exist. Just because we can't see the end of the universe, just because we think there is nothing outside the universe, on what grounds do we think there's nothing outside the universe? Have we got all knowledge? It's amazing. I'm very surprised at the way in which we are so limited in our thinking. If I said to you, for example, I've got something in my pocket that you've never seen before. In actual fact, I've got something in my pocket that no one has ever seen before. Except God, of course. Would you believe me? Would you believe that I could have brought something into this building which no one had ever seen before, not even I had seen before? And you being bright university undergraduates, not yet made your graduation to this great hall, you thought, oh, this is skeptical. I doubt that's possible. And so you think through in your own mind with regard to what is possible. What is the realm of my experience? What can actually he possibly have in his pocket that he, let alone anyone else, has never seen before? And therefore you think, well, it can't be true. I won't believe him. Even though he's a bishop, it's very disappointing. Perhaps you might think, well, look, I'm an Anglican. I've got to believe my bishop. I'll trust him. I'm glad there are a couple here. I'll trust him that what he says is actually true. That's what I'll do. I'll trust him. And therefore it comes, even though I say something to you which is beyond your experience, beyond even your undergraduate or graduate mind, to conceive of something, you'll trust the person who speaks. It's because God has spoken in the scriptures. He is trustworthy. He is a God who is real. He is a God who under undergirds our values. He's the God from whom value comes. He's not a God who is suspect to external laws, even the law of non-contradiction. God is inclusive of all things. God is beyond the beginning, because the word beginning is a time-related category. God is creator, and we are creature. God made us in his own image. In fact, the knowledge of God is resident in each one of you because you're image bearers. Of course, some of you don't believe in God because you suppress that knowledge. You refuse to believe in the God who reveals himself not only in the Bible, but in the whole world. God has not failed us. God has not failed us because he's spoken to us. He would have failed us if he'd not revealed himself to us, if he just got this world going and let us go off in our own mindless way. No, God entered into our world, entered into the misery of our world. God entered into our human being by becoming man. And God entered into this world in order that he might establish relationships between us and him. Relationships which from creation were broken. And the story of Adam and Eve in the Bible reflects that broken relationship. A relationship where the God who created all things and all things beautiful and good gave man will. And man and woman together in the image of God broke away from God and chose their own route and their own path. But God stepped into our shoes. God came and lived the life that neither you nor I could live, and he died the death that you and I deserve. Now, God has not failed us. God has actually succeeded. God has succeeded because he came to this world, and he's promised to come back again. And this debate for you might seem like just an interesting intellectual argument, but really it's much more important than that. The God who made you and the God who made the world is a God who has not failed you, and a God who actually is going to come back again and call you and me and everyone to account. That's the nature of the God who comes. Why do I believe that? Because the Bible explains it. The Bible makes it clear. The Bible speaks in terms of revealing God to us. It's the language which we have is the ability to understand particularity and universality, which is found in God. Greek philosophers would talk about what's more ultimate, unity or diversity? Well, in God, they're both equally ultimate. How can we speak about any individual item of knowledge without universal knowledge? It's impossible. It's meaningless. It's a grasping after wind. But God, the three-in-one God, where unity and diversity are equally ultimate, is the God who has revealed himself to us in the Bible, and particularly in the person of Jesus. So what's in my pocket? You might well ask. Do you believe that there's something in my pocket that no one has ever seen before? Is it possible? Is it possible, even though it's beyond your imagination? The God of all possibilities is the God who also made peanuts. And if you open up a peanut and see inside, you'll see for the very first time human eyes have ever looked upon this nut, encased within its shell, for no one else to see except you on this day of the debate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Glenn. We now move to our moderated section. Our speakers are going to stay in their chairs for that, and I'll help them talk to each other in a way that really connects with each other. I was going to start by asking Ian whether he did trust Glenn, that there was something in his pocket, but that thunder was somewhat stolen from me. Did you trust him before he revealed it, Ian?
Oh, I tend to be a little bit of a materialist and realist, and I had every reason to believe that he had something there. That I'm used to preachers with object lessons. I just don't think analogies of that kind help us very greatly, or talking about the foundations of the Great Hall, or why we can speak and reason. To me, this is just the way things are, and there's a causal assumption in much of what the bishop said. The atheist is often accused of having a naturalistic assumption, of not being open to the possibility of thinking in thought forms other than the natural, but the theist is always talking from the vantage of a cause that I have a bit of a problem with. But trust, of course, trust is very important. I mean, I trust people. I've learnt, though, that the only people you can really trust are those you don't need to trust.
Glenn, why was it that you moved us towards talking about trust? That seemed to be a different kind of a category, really, from the sort of categories that Ian was operating in. Why the category of trust? Does not that presuppose someone already to trust?
Indeed it does. The category of trust is a category of relationships. The most fundamental aspect of our lives is really relationships. We can talk about science and philosophy and a whole range of academic disciplines, but ultimately, what we're all made for is relationships. And we experience relationships, and we know when relationships are bad and relationships are good. And that those relationships, I contend, is a reflection of the fact we're made in the image of God. Even though we might suppress that knowledge of God, the image of God reveals itself from time to time, expresses itself in a way in which we can't escape it. And relationships are such that we know in a good relationship what really enjoyment of life is all about. And yet relationships are hard to define. They're not material. They're immaterial in one sense. But trust is a relationship which is a personal relationship. It's to do with our personhood. And the Bible, the God that the Bible reveals is a personal God, and therefore relationships is a personal attribute of God which we have in virtue of our being made in his image.
And thanks, Glenn. And the category of relationships, how would you respond to that? You've spoken mainly in terms of the arguments philosophically, but how would you respond to the notion that we should conduct a debate of this kind in the category of relationship?
I'm not sure I understand your question exactly, Andrew, but look, relationships are extremely important. I think William James spoke about the need, fundamental need that we have to have a sense of belonging. And I think that there's no joy in life except in relationships, although there's a lot of pain in it as well. I don't attribute the need for relationships and the desire in us to have meaningful relationships, though, to the existence of God. I think, for example, if you look at Charles Darwin's The Descent of Man, throughout the fourth chapter of that book, he accumulates example after example of altruistic, kindly, cooperative behavior between innumerable species of animals. And he comes to the view that this is a very necessary thing to survive. He came to the view that these instincts in animals were innate as part of the phylogenetic heritage of the species in question, and why should they not be also innate in us? I'm a bit odd. I do believe in objective moral values, but I don't attribute them to an all-powerful God or any sort of God. I just simply think that it's the nature of reality, that there are some values that are not subjective. I'm rare amongst my kind. I'm not a subjectivist in moral values. I'm an objectivist. We to some extent, have a bit in common with the bishop there, but I don't attribute them to some authority figure, just simply the way it is. There are some self-evident truths that are self-evidently objective. But relationships are extremely important. I understand what the bishop's saying about having a relationship with God. I understand his thought forms there entirely.
Glenn, you think there are some self-evident truths, like objective moral values?
Well, when you say self-evident, I believe they are self-evident in a Christian worldview at that level. But a person who denies that God exists, I find it difficult to know on what basis would any value direct your life, if it's self-evident, for example. So we're horrified, for example, that there might be polygamy in parts of Africa. We're horrified about pedophiles. Well, where do these moral values come from? I argue they come from a God who is a moral God, and God expresses those views. In a world which is random and undesigned and infinite without cause, then that's a chimera. I can't see how you'd have any real values in that world. To say they're self-evident, well, one person might think it's self-evident for me to take your money. Another person might think, no, I respect you and have your money. So what's self-evident to a person in a
a superdome in New Orleans might be different in another part of the world.
Yeah, and it does strike me that the category of self-evident reality is a somewhat dangerous one for you to introduce. How do you limit that?
My sense of what's objectively right and wrong comes as a result of the application of human reason to life as it exists. See, one of the things, whether we're all here now, human beings do exist. And I think when we apply human reason, we come to a self-evident truth that equals should be treated equally, that the unnecessary destruction of value is wrong. I'm not saying there are a lot of self-evident truths, but I think through the use of human reason, one can form a foundation for a basis of morality. The view that a humanist or an atheist can't be moral or can't have a code of morality because they don't have that sense of God is a very offensive one. And I would say that it's a view that is untenable. Nothing becomes right, no matter what God says. I think Buddha was right when he said, don't believe what's written in a holy book or what a person with authority says. Only believe it when it authenticates itself to you truly. The fact that God says this is no reason why we should obey it. The fact that something's written in the Bible, that may be a fact, but you can't derive a value from a fact. The fact that God commands X doesn't lead logically to the value that we ought to do X. I don't believe you can properly derive a valid system of morality from an appeal to authority or religion.
Glenn, do you think that people who don't believe in God don't have a moral value system?
No, I wouldn't believe that, because everyone's made in the image of God, and that's why they have a residual moral system. So that's not my argument. I wouldn't want to offend people on those lines. The fact is they're inconsistent. When they claim there is no God and then have a value system, I agree when Ian says facts don't give you oughts. So where do oughts come from? How does the person who believes there is no God, why should there be an ought? Why should one person, you know, say you ought to do this? There's no ground for any imperative at that level. There is no absolute. Without an absolute, everything is relative. And once you've said everything is relative, you've made an absolute. And so you're caught in this bind with regard to absolutes and relatives.
Do you feel caught in that bind?
I think certain acts can be judged by their consequences as more conducive than other acts to promote human welfare and well-being. We can have an argument about what does that, and there will be some cultural differences. I'm certainly not a relativist who believes that whatever you think is right, or whatever a culture thinks is right, because that gives the impress of infallibility to a person or a group of people or a culture, and that can't be right. I don't speak in terms of oughts. I think there are some things that are objectively right in the sense that they're more likely to promote human well-being than the reverse. And I think that a rational person does those things, not because they ought to, but because it is the rational thing to do. The only absolute that I believe in is reality. What is here now? That's an absolute as far as I'm concerned. And I think you can derive certain objective values from that without any need to appeal to an external authority.
Let's move on to some of the arguments that Ian raised in his opening address. Glenn, he spoke of the notion of God as presupposing a different order of reality, and argued that in a sense, can't be known because it can't be validated. How would you respond to the argument that the God notion presupposes a different order of reality, but by nature, by definition, we can't have access to a different order of reality, and therefore the God hypothesis remains at best unproved?
If you were starting with a God hypothesis, that is, if you were presupposing something, or if you were sort of suggesting something from yourself, from your point of view, then I think that would lead to a logical problem that Ian's outlined. The difference for me is that when God reveals himself in a way in which actually tells me who he is and tells me he's actually going to be beyond my comprehension, then it needs a certain epistemic humility with regard to understanding, I don't know everything. I can't have all knowledge. In actual fact, simply put, you can't have a knowledge of a particular unless you've got knowledge of a universal. This carpet might be red, but unless I understand all carpets and all things which are red, I can't make an absolute statement about this carpet being red. I attenuate an argument along those lines, but in actual fact, I'm caught in this bind of not having absolute knowledge. Now, when God reveals himself to us, he reveals himself as a God who actually has absolute knowledge. And therefore, from that knowledge base, I'm actually able to make real statements in this world which have meaning because an absolute knowledge exists.
Ian, do you think the carpet's red?
Yes, I do. But we won't get into phenomenalism and all of that. Look, I didn't actually say that I don't believe that there is more than one order of reality because you can't validate that. I'm not a logical positivist who believes that only that which can be validated is true. I take the view that that's putting the cart before the horse. Things can be validated because they're true. They're not true because they can be validated, and certain things might be true even though they can't be validated. What I said was, and there was a great professor of this philosophy here of this university from 1927 to 1958, Professor John Anderson, and he said that, look, logic is not about the way we think. Logic is about the way things in the world are related one to the other. It's a description of the way things are. Now, I simply say that it is impossible, logically, to conceive of there being any order or level of reality that other than what we're in now. And I think that a supernatural God does presuppose that. The bishop accuses me, or in a nice way, of saying, well, you don't have perfect knowledge, so how can you say that? The point is, we can only have knowledge of what we actually do have, and I think it's the theist that makes the presumption that wherever there is some uncertainty, we'll put a cross or a God figure there, whereas I would put a question mark. I mean, the fact that we don't have a naturalistic explanation for everything, and I don't concede that we do, is not good grounds, in my view, for postulating a supernatural explanation. There may well be a natural explanation for it. We haven't got it. We can't certainly rule out that possibility until we have knowledge of all supernatural, or knowledge of all natural explanations. But I prefer naturalistic explanations because I think that they are simpler than supernatural ones, because the supernatural explanation for something does require, of necessity, the existence of some additional figure, some additional order or level of reality, and an additional type of entity. Natural explanations are more conservative because they don't presuppose the violation of otherwise immutable laws, and they have more predictive power than supernatural explanations. That's why I tend to have a bias, if anything, towards that.
Glenn, do you hold a God of the gaps view?
No, I don't hold a God of the gaps, but I'm interested to know that where there are gaps, Ian puts a question mark in them. But what is not the question mark is it can't be God. Now, that seems to me to imply that you have a universal knowledge that it cannot be God. And you just can't make a proposition like that. You must allow the possibility that there are things beyond your ken, beyond that which you can validate, beyond that which you can logically understand even. You talk about immutable laws. On what grounds are they immutable? You can't say something is immutable unless you have universal knowledge. It's just not possible to speak like that. Citizens of this world have made all kinds of astounding remarks through the centuries, and yet later knowledge has proved them wrong. Now, I think we need to have a much greater sense of humility with regard to knowledge. On my view, knowledge can only have discourse and meaning if there's a God who actually has all knowledge.
Ian?
Look, I just don't think that we can postulate the existence of some order level of reality for which there is no evidence. The bishop says, you know, we need to be humble about this. We can't say that miracles don't occur. I just haven't seen any evidence for them. The bishop would say that the resurrection is one, but we're not here to debate that today unless the debate touches on that. But I have never seen any logically probative material worth believing that natural laws are anything other than immutable and can't be violated. To say that what right do I have to say that? On the basis of the regularity and consistency and ever-repeatedness of the natural world. The onus is on you to assert some evidence that there is an order or level of reality to the contrary. It's not one that we ordinarily engage in or interact with.
Well, my answer would be that all facts are God's facts. Everything in this world points to the Creator God. Our problem, when I say our human problem, is that we can't see things clearly. We've got like rose-coloured glasses.
And also, please make your questions just that, questions. If they are just merely comments, I will prompt a question from you, or else we'll have to go to another one. Sir.
Yes.
Ian?
Yeah, well, look, I wouldn't want to give the impression that any system of morality or ethics that I have is based entirely
Sorry
on...
Sorry to interrupt you, Ian. Could you just repeat the question?
Yeah, I think what the... Yes, sure. The gentleman was sort of saying that when I quoted from Charles Darwin from The Descent of Man, the fourth chapter where Darwin accumulated examples of cooperative behaviour among social animals, I did intimate in an answer to a question previously that... such altruism and examples of cooperative behaviour had great survival value and were intended in order to preserve the survival of the species, and that has been questioned as whether that's a proper basis on which to have a system of morality. That was part of what I think he was saying. I want to read from what he actually wrote in The Descent of Man. We haven't got time to go through it all, but he accumulated examples of cooperative behaviour among social animals. And he said this, quote, "It can hardly be disputed that the social feelings are instinctive or innate in the lower animals, and why should they be not so in man?" And he then went on to give what I think is the classical humanist view of the social basis of morals. He said, quote, "The social instincts, the prime principle of man's moral constitution, with the aid of active intellectual powers and the effects of habit, naturally lead to the golden rule, as ye would that men should do to you, do ye to them likewise, and this lies at the foundation of morality." So I perhaps didn't exactly quote it with the precision that I should have. It's more than just survival value, but certainly this idea that our social feelings are instinctive or innate, and that when we exercise active intellectual powers and reason and have regard to the consequences of our actions, together with a certain amount of cultural conditioning or social conditioning, the effects of habit, we do get the golden rule or something like that. I think he's saying that the sense of what is right and wrong, at least at a very crude, rudimentary level, is built into us. And whether that's the result of the non-purposive workings, as I see them, the non-purposive workings of natural selection or otherwise, I really don't know. But I do think that any appeal to external authority for a system of ethical values is fundamentally flawed.
Thank you. Glenn, would you like to add anything?
I'm pretty sure at the end of Darwin's first edition of Origin of Species that he actually says, "And God made all things." He was coming out of a Christian context, although he did change his views later on. But I think my concern is you've still got the problem with regard to how do you get those moral values without some sense of an absolute value. And otherwise, moral values become relative. I can't see how you can move to an absolute value in terms of what ought to happen or what is a good thing, what is a moral thing, unless you've got an absolute.
Thank you. Question? Yes. Would you mind repeating the question before you answer
it? I would not mind repeating the question. The question is, how do you know the Bible is true? How do you know that the stories about Jesus are accurate and reflect what actually happened? Correct? That's a good question, and it requires probably a longer answer than I can give in this setting. The Old Testament was written over a period of about 1,000 years, and there are 39 books in the Old Testament.
And when you come to the first century, that is a collected set of scriptures which Jesus himself identifies as being that which is God's word to the people of Israel. Then the writings with regard to Jesus and the apostles following on are all written within the first century. So when Jesus died around 30-33 AD, they're all written, some would argue before 70 AD, so it's some would think maybe into the 90s. Therefore, you've got a fairly short period of time where you've still got eyewitnesses there. Most of the histories we have of the ancient world, Roman histories and Greek histories, are written hundreds of years later after the events. This is almost unique in terms of the writing, the contemporaneous writing of the events, the record of the events, by a number of different authors. It's not just one author who's written, unlike some religious texts where it's just one person who's written the whole set. This is written by a variety of authors over a variety of different locations geographically, but all attesting to the one truth with regard to Jesus. And more than that, they also attest to the fact that they were not writing just merely human words, but God was actually involved in the writing of these words. Now, that's, again, the self-attestation of the scripture, where God writes these words using humans in such a way that it is the word of God which you actually hear or read when you read the New Testament or the Old Testament. Sorry for the brevity of that answer. I mean, you could look at historical data and a whole range of things which identify the historicity of that, but basically it comes from the events of Jesus and his commissioning of apostles to actually teach what he taught, write down, bring to remembrance the things that have taken place in his lifetime.
Thank you, Glenn. Ian, would you like to add anything?
Oh, just briefly, Ryan. I don't place the same weight on the Bible. I mean, we don't have the original manuscript for any book of the Bible. What we have are copies of copies of copies, many times over, translations of translations of translations in several different languages. None of these would be admissible in any Australian court under the Evidence Act to establish the authenticity of their contents or their supposed originals. I mean, the oldest, correct me if I'm wrong, but the oldest manuscript support for the Old Testament would be the Qumran material, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I'm told that they date to between the end of the 3rd century BC and 70 AD. So we're looking at a bare minimum of 300 years after the Old Testament, last Old Testament book was composed, and that's quite a long period thereafter, a bare minimum of 300 years. So far as the New Testament's concerned, we have a 2nd century copy of a few verses from John's Gospel, the earliest substantial manuscript support for New Testament material, the Chester Beatty Papyri, dates to the 3rd century. The first complete New Testament manuscript, the Codex Sinaiticus, it dates to the 4th century. So the oldest manuscript containing most of the books of the New Testament was written at least 120 years after the originals were supposedly composed. So, and the oldest complete New Testament manuscript postulates the originals by at least 220 years. So, I mean, without going into what I see as a number of problems in the text itself and contradictions and errors, I don't think that we've got documents that are all that contemporaneous to the events that they describe. It requires quite a bit of trust to actually assume that those documents are faithful.
Okay. If I may just add to that, thank you, Ian. I think those figures you give are correct. Until the Qumran caves were discovered in the 20th century, the oldest Old Testament manuscripts we had were about 600 to 700 AD. And the remarkable thing is that when these documents were found, and they're Hebrew documents in the Qumran scrolls, there was a remarkable accuracy with regard to the Hebrew text which we had from the 700s, 800s AD, and what we have in the 2nd century BC. Now, obviously, completely different origins, in as much as there were certain differences of style and places here and there, but the remarkable similarity of what we have is astounding. What we have, though, is if you think in terms of, and Ian can correct me, that I can't think of any document from the ancient world that was written within such a close time to the events, nor to have so many translations of that. I'm thinking of Syriac, Coptic, Greek, Hebrew, Latin. And you just don't get that for Roman annals, you don't get that for Greek history. The fact that it is a spread geographically, there's a very informed science of textual criticism with regard to the analysing the texts and what we have, and some of them come from, they're not dependent upon one another, they're intertextual links which provide for us a very clear view of the original. We don't have the original manuscripts, that's absolutely true. I can't think of any history prior to 500 AD where we have any original manuscripts. And that's not the case in the first century, but we do have such a plethora of testaments and witnesses and manuscripts attesting to these events that I think gives us a very good solid foundation.
Thank you both for those answers. Do we have another question? Yes.
The question is, do you believe we have free will? I think it probably, I can't answer that question unless you define what free will is. If, for example, I said to you, have you got freedom of movement in this great hall? And you might say, yes, I'm free to move where I want to. Well, could you just put your feet upon the ceiling at the moment? And the answer is no, I'm not free to do that. So therefore, your free will of movement is circumscribed by other limitations. In terms of free will, if you think of free in terms of unfettered to do anything, then we don't have free will. We can't will anything to do anything. Right? We have what I believe is a better description, real will. We have real options. We can make real decisions, and they have real consequences. And that's the way in which God made us, with a real will, rather than what I might call an unfettered, unreal free will. You might want to come back to me on that. The question is, if God is all-knowing and therefore knows what's going to happen in the future and therefore knows what we're going to do, we don't have free will. That's the absolute. If I was to flip a coin, which I haven't got because I'm such a poor person, was I getting paid for this? Oh, sorry. If I was to flip a coin and put it on my hand like that, what's the probability that it's heads or tails? 50%. Well, that's not quite true. It's actually one or zero. The event's taken place, you see. From an epistemological point of view, it's 50%. From an ontological point of view, it's one or zero. You've answered your own question. Thank you.
I don't have a problem with anything that the bishop said there and would agree with that, except for the causal presupposition in relation to God. But what he said about free will, I think is right. Where I brought it up to was in relation to gratuitous evil and suffering. I mean, if I were a theist, I think I could explain why things like what's happened in New Orleans happen. That doesn't worry me so much. It troubles me more, say, when a young child of two or three dies of a brain tumour. That I have some trouble with. A person who dies at 65 from lung cancer, who smoked all his life, I don't have a problem with that. I don't regard that as gratuitous suffering. But I do have some difficulty with the idea, why couldn't a God who is all-powerful have created human beings with free will, in the sense described, but with the ability, but who chose to exercise that will one way and one way only? Let me give you a limited example. In the field of alcoholism, for example, if an alcoholic is someone who has not only a bad habit, they've actually got a form of obsessive-compulsive disorder where they take a drink and it sets up a mental obsession and a physical compulsion, and they've lost their ability to choose, to say no. They don't have free will anymore in the sense they're compelled to keep drinking even though it has deleterious effects. If they get into recovery through whatever program, like AA or whatever, they regain their power of choice and their free will. And they have it only for so long as they choose not to exercise their free will, or to choose to exercise it only one way and one way only, to choose not to drink. If they were to exercise their free will the other way, they would be back on the into active addiction. So what I'm saying is, it's possible for humans to have free will, but to choose to exercise it one way and one way only. And I can't see why an all-powerful God could not have created us ontologically that way, where we could exercise our free will and one way only, still have free will, but choose to exercise it in a way that didn't bring evil into the world, as we're told it did.
Thank you. Do we have a question?
Thank you. That's a very good question. The gentleman asked, how do I account for the radical transformation in the Apostle Paul with the Damascus Road experience? And there's no doubt if I'm making a conditional statement here rather than an argument, it's like, if the Bible is true, Jesus must have been either insane or what he said he was or a liar. It's a conditional statement, you see. If the Bible is correct in what it describes there, there was certainly an incredible transformation in that place. I see such transformations occurring on a daily basis in certain groups that I belong in certain organizations. I see incredible changes in the personality and whole displacements in people's being when they get a sense of a power other than themselves, various things like that. If you read what I think is still the best book ever written on religion, William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, you'll find there he goes through a number of different religions and healing cults and sees an incredible phenomenon where people have remarkable experiences that some would call miracles. But for the most part, it's a naturalistic explanation of what happens there. I mean, people do have major changes like that where they're living their life one way and they have a conversion or surrender experience. I don't choose to interpret that or describe that in supernatural terms. I think that those sort of changes can be explained by a number of things, but I see it as a psychological experience, but very, very profound, and can bring healing to people at very profound levels. And I think this is where the church is often at its best, in providing forums and atmospheres for which this sort of healing experience can take place. But I don't attribute these examples of change in people to any notions of supernaturalism.
Glenn?
If you don't believe in God, then you're not going to believe in a change that takes place in a person like the Apostle Paul, and therefore it'll be difficult to explain it. You'll explain it through natural means. But Paul's own testimony is that it was a supernatural event that changed him. It's always good to listen to the person who's actually having the experience, and Paul's own testimony to that says that God worked through him and changed him to actually see the world for what it truly is, a world made by God, a world which had purpose, and a world which Jesus lived, died, rose again, and was coming back again. And therefore the transformation led him to a life of bearing witness to that event and to the return of Jesus.
Thank you. Do we have a question? Yes.
The question is difficult for me to repeat. the question was my statement with regard to how can you speak of immutable laws? And my question was with regard to Ian used that term. And my argument was, and therefore the question is, how can I have an immutable God written through human authors? Have I got your question correct or not? Sorry. Correct. Thank you. How can I claim an immutable God if I've just lampooned, as it were, anyone who's makes a claim that anything is immutable? My comments about a claim for this an immutable law is on the basis there is no God. If you don't have a God, if you don't have an immutable God, then you can't have anything which is immutable. From my assumption, because God is unchanging, because God is trustworthy, because he is reliable and truthful, it's that that gives the opportunity and from which we can predicate any truth statements today. I mean, I can make certain statements what is true. I can say it's immutably true that Jesus will return. We can't say it's immutably true the sun will rise tomorrow. We might get up tomorrow and find the sun has risen, but we can't at this point of view, this point in time, saying the sun will immutably rise tomorrow because the event hasn't happened yet. And for all I know is Jesus could come back tonight, in which case the sun won't rise tomorrow. So it's having a God from whom we then predicate statements which give universal laws and universal values to things. If you have no God, if you have no universal, if you have no comprehensive knowledge, then you are building ladders out of water to state that there are immutable things here. You can't have it both ways.
Thank you, Glenn. Ian?
Just briefly, I believe that it's valid to logically deduce from what is certain predictions, make certain statements and The law, what we call the laws of nature, are nothing more than descriptions of regular processes that occur in the world. Those processes may change, but on the basis of past behaviour, we've got every reason to believe that they will continue. I mentioned earlier about a spatially infinite universe, and it's true, not all scientists agree that the universe is infinite or spatially infinite. There is some debate about what is meant by infinite, and some scientists say it's spatially infinite in potentiality, because what we have discovered in just the last 10 years, which has reversed our previous thinking, is that the universe space expansion rate is accelerating, ever-accelerating expansion rate. 1998, we discovered that, and that's led us to believe that if that process continues, the universe is spatially infinite. But we could be wrong on that. But I say that there's every good reason for believing that that is right, on the basis of the material that we have. That's about all I'll say about that.
Okay, thank you. There was another question beforehand. Yes, down the back.
Right. Well, the question basically is, because there are some question marks, because there is some doubt in relation to the explanations of certain phenomena, that how can I say with any certainty that there couldn't be a possibility of God existing? Without going into, well, we'll go into one specific. On the basis of current scientific cosmology, we can say that there's a 95% probability that the universe, our universe, would come into existence. Hawking and others have said that. Now, why is that figure only 95? Why? And we're very dogmatic about that 95. Why is it not 100%? Why is there not 100% probability, which would be a certainty, that our universe came into existence? Well, if the theist is right, it would be 100%. Because whatever God willed to happen would happen and would have happened. The fact that it's 95% and not 100% works against the theist's view that it was caused by God. What is 100%, according to Hawking and others, is that there's 100% certainty that a universe with our universe's characteristics would come into existence uncaused. That a universe with our universe's characteristics would come into existence uncaused, the probability of that occurring, 100%. Based on the wave function of the universe that I described earlier, based on assigning numbers to the possibility of all other universes, and they all cancel each other out, except for the universe with our universe's characteristics, with living organisms. So I think we can be pretty sure that even though there are question marks, like, for example, evolution, it's a fact and it's a theory. There are question marks about certain aspects of that theory, like sequentiation and various species, but the relationships between various species. But basically, it's an immutable fact that it did happen. Even if there was something really big that we didn't have a naturalistic explanation for, that's no reason to put a cross there, the Christian cross. That's no reason to put a God. It's simply, as I said earlier, the possibility that, more likely, that we haven't yet got a naturalistic explanation for it. I remain of the view that supernatural explanations are contrary to the very nature and possibility of meaningful discourse. And when you go here sometime today, go up to the university website of this university, find the site with John Anderson's papers on, and look at his 1926 article, Empiricism, and you'll find out why supernaturalism is contrary to the very nature and possibility of meaningful discourse.
Thank you. Ian, do you have anything to say, Glenn?
Except to say quite the contrary, from my point of view, that meaningful discourse only exists where a God has created this world. But I'm surprised, humoured, I think, by Ian's confidence with which he says, well, at this, as much as we know about science at the moment, the previous answer was talking about the infinite universe. Well, 10 years ago, he would have made exactly the same statement in the reverse. So how do we know in 10 years' time that science will not find some other interesting thing and fact about God's universe? The point is, we just do not know. It's all very well for Hawking to make such bold assertions with 100% certainty. I find that amusing itself. You can't predict those kind of things. In the same way, if we don't know what took place at the beginning of the world, we have all kinds of, because no one was there, and what we have is God's telling us that he created all things, and we don't know any prediction about tomorrow. Of course, we'll work on the basis tomorrow that, yes, we've normally seen the sun rise every morning and the likelihood of its rising tomorrow is very strong. Absolutely. But you cannot say with 100% certainty that it will rise tomorrow. And anything other, and to assert that is highly gullible and self-deceived.
But I didn't say that, Glenn.
No, I didn't. But it is still highly gullible and self-deceived.
I agree.
Is there another question? Yes.
I don't think that's hard to explain. I think science theory and evidence does tell us what happened, how it happened, what's going to happen to the universe. It will eventually, as a result of the Big Bang, and I'm pretty sure that did happen, most theists agree on that too. We've got 100 billion or more universes that are rushing away from each other headlong, and they will eventually zip out of view and descend into black holes and dead matter and eventually disintegrate, and probably in trillions of years' time another Big Bang. This is what scientists, generally speaking, predict. When precisely it will happen is another matter. I think science has largely told us why it happened too. Not why in the sense of any purpose, because I think that if God did exist, God wouldn't need to act purposefully. Anything that God, as Viscount Haldane said years ago, if God did exist and did create things, then God wouldn't need to act purposely, because anything that God willed or wanted to exist would happen automatically. So why interpolate the notion of purpose? I think we know why the universe existed. Philosophers of science, such as Quentin Smith, have said the universe exists because there was a predominant probability of it coming into existence, given the elements that were there at or near the time of the Big Bang. It couldn't help but come into existence. That doesn't introduce a notion of purpose that may be very satisfying to people here. But science does say the universe exists because it couldn't help but coming into existence. And that's the best answer that I can give you.
Okay. Glenn, would you like to...
I think the only comment I want to make, this is such speculation. What were the elements prior to their state whereby they necessarily had to come into the existence of the universe? And was that a period of time? And was that a necessary movement from their existence, if you like, before they actually come in terms of the combination of what we know as the universe? These things are such speculation that I find it very difficult for us to make any meaningful take any meaningful measures out of these speculations.
But I don't really want to comment on that, but I think we could have an interesting interchange on that. I think it's not just speculation. In 1965, two astronomers discovered the leftover glow from the Big Bang. That's now acknowledged. As to what was there before, science tells us that there was, near the beginning, there was. So you've got to start with the universe seems to be all that is, totally self-contained. There's nothing outside the universe. There was nothing existing temporally before the universe began to exist. There was no time. There was only a timeless space. Go right back to the beginning. It was little more than the size of the nucleus of an atom, 10 centimeters in radius. That's how it began. That's not speculation. That is what scientists actually tell us, based on the research that we have. Now, I'm not a scientist, so I'm going to get out of my depth, but I'm a lawyer who knows something about words and how words are used and put together, and someone who can judge the probative value of evidence. That's all I can do. But I think it's more than speculation. I think that the jury's out on that matter, or in.
Just
for a lawyer, I got that wrong.
Just one final word. Ian spoke about timeless space. Early in the debate, he talked about time and space being together, and you can't have one without the other. So this shows you the difficulty we have. What does timeless space mean? We can't conceive of something outside of time. That's our problem, because we're finite. We're time-bound. We're creatures at that level. And that's the difference in terms of because God creates time, that it puts a different perspective on it.
Thank you. Yes.
The question relates to if the universe is spatially infinite in both directions, if the universe is all that there is, if it has no boundaries, and if time didn't exist before, how can I make these predictions in relation to the universe sort of collapsing and starting all over again? First of all, not all scientists are convinced that it will start all over again, but most seem to say that at the time of the Big Bang, there was one or more explosions that resulted in a line of simultaneous causes and effects. Simultaneous causes and effects with instantaneous causal relations between those simultaneous events, such that everything that we have was caused by some other part of this self-contained universe. Now, given that there's 100 billion galaxies or more and they're all rushing headlong throughout space, it's believed by most that they will eventually zip out of view, collapse, disintegrate into black holes, and loose particles will eventually bind together and perhaps create another Big Bang. We're talking about trillions of years. I personally don't worry about it too much in the sense of whether I won't be around when it happens, none of us will be, but I don't have any difficulty in conceiving of the possibility of there being another Big Bang. If the universe is totally self-contained, and all that there is, with nothing outside the universe, then why couldn't this possibility keep happening again and again and again to this totally self-enclosed system, which science seems to suggest that there is?
Thank you, Ian. Do you have anything to add, Glenn?
Just the presupposition that this universe is all there is, and that's the basis of those conjectures from scientists, and that's the problem. Because all you can see is the universe, and because you can't conceive of something outside the universe, there lies the problem. But when someone from outside the universe reveals himself into our universe, that's something with which we have to take account.
Thank you. We have two questions at the front here. The first one.
Thank you. What do I think the purpose of the universe is, and what do I think the purpose of man is? Purpose is very much tied up with the concept of meaning. And to speak about life being meaningful is a difficult concept for me, because meaningful presupposes the existence of meaning, and I don't believe that life is intrinsically meaningful, although I do believe that we can bestow meaning upon life, and I think that starts from a recognition of what is and us adjusting ourselves to what is, which is in a sense what the Christian sometimes talks about in submission to the will of God. I would see that in more secular terms as adjusting oneself to what is, rather than adjusting the world to the way you'd like it to be. So I have an empirical sense there, but I don't believe that the world was created, so therefore I believe the world was self-created, right? So I don't believe that there is any intrinsic purpose or meaning to life, but that's not to say that life is pointless, as the Christian will often say, life must be pointless. I love life, I love every bit of it. And the fact that I believe it will come to an end for me in 20, 30, 50 years makes it even more wonderful. I don't have a problem with that. I worship what is, I have reverence and awe for life, and in a sense, I believe that the most value in life that I can get, the most happiness, is in seeking to give and to lose myself in others. And there is one verse that I like in the Bible that says, in 1 Peter, about Christ died, leaving us an example that we should follow in his steps. I would see Jesus as the great example rather than the great exception. But the purpose of life, now I find that a meaningless question. I believe that purpose can only be said to relate to certain cognitively significant propositions, and what we're talking about today is not one of them. I think it exists, as I said, because it had a predominant probability of beginning to exist, and that's as much as there is. I don't see any purpose in life existing. It just does exist. I don't have a problem with that. To me, it's so logically self-evident that life just exists. To read purpose into it. I mean, we can see purpose. It's like saying, you know, a bird has wings so that it can fly. It flies because it has wings. I don't see why we have to put purpose into everything.
Well, thank you, Ian. Do you want to respond, Glenn?
Just the final remark, you don't have to put purpose into everything. And then you said you bestow purpose upon certain things or meaning upon certain things. The two to me seem to be contradictory. Why would you want to bestow meaning upon anything just because things happen to be? However, I think I'm delighted to see that at least one verse from the Bible has captured your imagination.
Oh.
Which just goes to prove that that God has still fresh light to shine from his word upon
yes.
you. There's just a couple of thousand
verses. I could quote a lot more that appeal to me as well.
You can't suppress the knowledge of God completely.
Thank you, Glenn. We'll go to the
That's right.
next question. Yes.
The relevance of Jesus and in relation to his historicity and relevance. On balance, outside the debate, I'm prepared to concede that it's more probable than not that Jesus did exist. Regrettably, the extra-biblical evidence for his existence is very scant, and most thinking Christians do acknowledge that. But I think it's more probable. I think one of the strongest arguments for his existence is the fact that when we look at the New Testament, the sayings attributed to him, and even an atheist like Lord Haldane pointed this out, there seems to be a coherence to the sayings, like they came from the one mouth of the one person. So I think it's probably more probable than not that he did exist. The view that I've come to as a result of studies of comparative religion is that the Jesus of the Bible is probably nothing like the Jesus that did in fact exist. And I think that for my part, Christianity was largely invented by St. Paul, and that it's a very different kettle of fish from the simple sayings of Jesus. For me, Christianity is the religion that Jesus lived by, the religion that he taught, rather than a religion about Jesus. And apart from a couple of verses in the Gospels, which are regarded by many scriptural authorities as unauthentic, showing a hyper-Pauline influence upon the Gospel writers, I don't believe that Jesus saw his death as any form of necessary propitiation or expiation for our sins. There are a couple of verses in the Gospels that the bishop would know better than I do say that, but there is doubt about a couple of those. But probably we haven't got time to debate that today, but I believe that Jesus was a very different person than the Jesus that the church has led us to believe. I believe that the church has carnalized a myth that began in Egypt with the death of the dying and rising God, that one can trace from Egypt through all of the Middle East, through Greece and Rome and other Greco-Roman mystery religions, and finally took the form in Christianity. I believe it's a carnalized myth, but there may well have been a real person behind it. As far as I'm concerned, Jesus is still a good role model and exemplar and example, and I'm sorry I don't go any further than that in relation to him, and I wouldn't necessarily place him above certain other people either in terms of moral worth or significance.
And I suppose the proof will be in the pudding, in as much as if you read the New Testament and read about Jesus. Yes, there are some scholars, I wouldn't say it's a multitude of scholars, who dissect and try to colour code the Gospels as to what were the true sayings of Jesus, etc. But by and large, the Christian church has for centuries believed that is a true characterisation, a true historical record of who Jesus was, what he said he would do, and the fact he would return. And when Jesus does return, no one's going to nudge their neighbour and say, well, who is that? He'll actually be self-attesting, self-authenticating. We won't need a third authority or a second authority to try and establish who is this Jesus. He will come and command loyalty from this whole world. And at that level, he is self-authenticating.
Thank you, Glenn. It's 10:02, so this will be our last question. Up the back.
It's a good question. How can I assert that anyone or anything has some sort of objective value in a totally naturalistic view of life and the universe? As I said earlier, my starting point is that whatever exists has value because it exists. And I think certain, I believe in natural law, not in terms of any ecclesiastical bias, but I do believe that people are intrinsically valuable. You asked me why I come to that view in a totally naturalistic, because I attribute value to the natural world. I attribute value to it by reason of its beauty, by reason of the fact that it is intelligible to me, not in terms of any intelligent design or purpose, but just simply because it operates in ways that are rational and intelligible to me, and that I have found through human experience certain things are conducive to happiness and well-being, and therefore I attribute value to it. I simply start from the recognition that whatever is value. I believe it's a self-evident truth that the unnecessary destruction of value is wrong. I believe it's a self-evident truth that equals should be treated equally, that discrimination is inherently wrong. I mean, these are self-evident truths to me. I don't need Buddha or Jesus to tell me that those things are so. I believe, for example, that gambling is wrong, not because of any church bias or wowserism on my part. I often say to my students down the road, I believe gambling is wrong. I remember Alan Walker, a Methodist minister of yesteryear, said it's wrong. He said, not because Jesus said it was wrong. It's wrong because you win at your brother's expense. And that sort of win-lose situation is, to me, self-evidently wrong. And you don't need to appeal to authority. If you appeal to authority, you'll get extra support for that view. But I don't believe that you need to appeal to authority for that. It's self-evident to me, even though I accept a lot of people don't seem to agree with me.
Thank you, Ian. Would you like to say anything, Glenn?
Well, just because something is, Ian espouses value for that. I wonder if there's value for crime, for murder, for disease, for death itself. Where do the values come from? I think that's my overarching concern, and the fundamental difference between Ian and myself is that the value just doesn't come. It's not self-evident in a vacuum. Because in the history of humankind, people have different sets of values. And you may find yourself with different sets of values when you leave university. Different values you've brought from school you may have discarded. Values change. And the question is, what are the right values? What are the right virtues in terms of the biblical language? And at that level, the way in which the Bible expounds, yes, gambling is wrong because of its consequences, but it's wrong because God says it is wrong. And there are reasons why it is wrong. It's not arbitrary. God's not an arbitrary God. He's a God of love. He's a God of relationships. He's a God who has our good at heart. And that's why he's not failed us. And that's why this world continues to exist, for people to turn to him and find the fullness of their being in a relationship with him.
Oh, well, thank you, Glenn. That brings our question time to a close. Thanks must go once again to our speakers, Mr. Ian Ellis-Jones and Dr. Glenn Davies, for engaging with our questions in such a diligent manner. Let's thank them now.